Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Okay. Hi, my name is Elisa Minkin. I am a general pediatrician. I'm co-chair of the JOMA, Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association Preventative Health Committee, and I am so excited to be here today with Dr. Michael Osterholm. Hi.
Good morning.
Thank you so much. I'm going to say a little bit about you. Dr. Osterholm is the director of CIDRAP, the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. He's also the chair of public health and a professor at the University of Minnesota. He's an internationally recognized expert in epidemiology, public health, and pandemic preparedness with a distinguished career spanning over 45 years. He's the author of two New York Times bestselling books. The latest is The Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. And he has a weekly podcast on COVID-19 related topics where he gives straight talk on COVID-19, which is amazing. And Mazel Tov on being appointed to the president-elect Joe Biden's 13-member transition COVID-19 advisory board.
Thank you. It's good to be with you. I appreciate it. And I appreciate your outreach that you're doing. This is critical. We all are trying to contribute in our own ways. So congratulations to you and thank you.
Thank you. I feel like one thing we can say is we are all sick of COVID. We all agree we're sick of COVID, but we don't agree on everything else about COVID. So I have some things I've heard people say, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on them. And I'll start with, yes, we have lots more COVID, but it's not the same disease. It's milder.
Well, first of all, what we have to look at is in terms of when we say we have more or less COVID, you know, what numbers can we use that actually would tell us this? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can debate about how many infections occur in our community relative to mild illness. People never get tested, never get followed up on. And that's a fair question. But what we can't dismiss is how many people become severely ill and are mm-hmm. hospitalized and die. Those are kind of the tips of the iceberg that give you a very good understanding of what's under the waterline. What are the more cases out there? So if I pick up more of what's underneath the waterline, I may pick up more milder cases. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean that what's above the waterline, the severe illnesses and the deaths have not increased. Today we're reporting 218,000 cases. Remember when New York was a house on fire in April, and we were reporting 32,000 cases a day in this country. You know, we're reporting almost eightfold increased number of cases versus then. If you look at deaths, we're now back up into the number of deaths every day occurring from COVID. Yesterday, we hit 3,700 deaths in this country. COVID was the number one cause of death in the country. This is what we saw back last April. And there's a really important difference this time. What we saw back in April, and New York was at the forefront of this, was the fact that we didn't understand much about the disease. And intensive care units did everything they could with what we thought the disease was doing and how to treat it. And I think one of the really unsung hero activities, one of the real bright spots in this entire pandemic, has been what the intensive care teams around the world, and right particularly in New York, have taught us about how to appropriately treat COVID-19 in its severest form. It wasn't blockbuster drugs. It wasn't some new magical pixie dust that entered into the intensive care wards. It was good medical practice, understanding how to basically keep people's oxygen levels up. Mm-hmm. It was about how to support them so that they didn't develop this vasculitis or this inflammation of your blood vessels that would develop blood clots and then cause more health problems. And so we brought the percentage of people who went to intensive care units who ultimately died down dramatically, 60 to 70% reduction with better medical care throughout the summer for those who had become severely ill. So we drove the number of deaths down even in July when we saw another spike in activity in places like Georgia and Florida and Arizona and Texas and California, the number of deaths continued to come down. What's different now is we are overwhelming our healthcare systems with such a large number of cases. We can't provide the same level of intensive care medicine that we were doing. We just don't have enough healthcare workers around the country. When New York was in such a challenged state last April, people volunteered from around the United States to come and help. And you know, again, my hat's off to what the you know, greater New York City metropolitan area docs did. It was remarkable, but they had help too. Right now, they can't get help, nor can we get help here in Minneapolis, nor can people in LA get help, because everybody has got right now major activity going on that requires healthcare workers to be there. So I think the difference we're seeing right now, which is really important, is the fact that we are seeing this big spike in deaths, despite knowing what we know. And that tells you how much activity is in our communities with virus, and it tells you also about how stretched our healthcare systems are.
Mm. Now, do you think that there are certain areas of New York, because, you know, when you talk about numbers, those numbers were an underestimate. We weren't testing as much. So it wasn't 32,000. It was much, much more. We were just getting the tip of the iceberg. So there are people in some communities that were hit so hard, and they're saying, well, we have herd immunity here.
Yeah, and that's a very important point. And I absolutely acknowledge that we missed a lot of cases back in March, April. But what we have learned is using what we call serology studies, looking at antibody, meaning that you have been previously infected at some time, and even knowing that that can wane a bit so that we may not pick up everyone with our antibody studies that might have been infected in March and April. But, you know, there are surely neighborhoods in New York City where we saw the upwards of 30 to 40% of the population potentially infected back then. That's on the high end. But that leaves many, many more people yet not infected and can still get infected. And what we talk about is this concept called herd immunity. Herd immunity is an epidemiologic concept that says, imagine it's really just as if the virus is one big reactor and these are all rods you put into it to slow down transmission. So if 30, 40% of the population has already been infected and are immune to a future infection, then when you're in the room, 30 or 40% of the people you might come in contact with, if you're infected, won't get infected from you, and it slows down the transmission. Herd immunity, as we best estimate it with this disease, probably requires 50 to 70% of the population to become infected before it just slows the virus down. It doesn't stop it. You know, this is akin to, you know, the pilot coming on announcing 30 minutes before landing, we're about to begin our descent into Kennedy International Airport. Doesn't mean you're on the ground yet. And so that what we have happening here is that you can see slower transmission when you hit 50 to 70%, but even then it still transmits. So I think that for the vast majority of neighborhoods in New York, we still really do have the potential for lots of case transmission to occur, realizing, however, they've already obviously suffered a lot already. But that's all the more reason why we have to help people understand just how powerful this virus transmission is.
Right, right. And there are people who say masks don't work. So that's a whole other problem.
Well, you know, I think this is an area that we need to really clarify. You know, our group has tried with all the scientific nuance we can to do that. We have to look at what does a mask mean? Okay, it's like talking about a human. You know, who is a human? What is a human? Masks all are different in terms of how they protect us. If we use the N95 respirator, that thing that we, that type of device we use inside of healthcare settings, those are basically very specially fitted respiratory protection devices so that there aren't any leaks along the sides. I mean, it's like your swim goggles. When's the last time you put goggles on that leak through the glass? They leak along the sides. Mm-hmm. So these are very tight face-fitting devices. Plus, the material is very special in that it's porous enough to let air move relatively easily in and out, but it has an electrostatic charge because the spaces in that material is actually bigger than the virus itself. So otherwise, the virus would come blowing right through. but the electrostatic charge stops it. So that's why they're so effective. And these are highly effective. And, you know, we want, you know, if everybody could have an N95 respirator right now and use those for several weeks, oh man, could we have a major impact on this pandemic? But we don't. Next is surgical masks. These were traditionally worn by healthcare workers initially to help them preventing from blowing any of their large droplets as they breathe into a surgical wound or into someone else. And that was really the primary reason for those. Those are loose face fitting on the side. So when I breathe in and out, the air escapes in and out of those, and it doesn't trap all the droplets I blow out, or even these very fine particles called aerosols. Aerosols are those things that, for someone, for example, who uses an expensive perfume, I say oil-based perfume, you know, if you spray it in a room, you can smell it sometime far a distance away. That's what an aerosol is. They float, they last in the room for some time. Next time you see the sunlight coming in the window of your home, particularly during the winter, and you see all that dust floating. That's not dust, that's aerosols. Those are the things that just stay suspended. So with surgical masks, you have more protection than nothing, but not as good as an N95. The face cloth coverings are loose fitting, and their material often allows the virus to pass through. So there you have a reduction in either you blowing out the virus or inhaling the virus. But what you don't have is perfect protection. And so what we have continued to really emphasize is that if you're using surgical masks or face cloth coverings, you still have to distance. You know, be mindful of the fact that, you know, you're around potential crowds where they could be infected and you don't want to get exposed. So it's a combination, it's a layered effect. So it's like Swiss cheese. You know, if I put one piece on the table, I can see a lot of the table through the holes. But if I took two pieces, I can see less of the table. Pretty soon, three or four, I can't see the table anymore, okay? That's what masking, as we think of it today, is a layered effect. Do it, but understand there's a limitation for just how much it will protect you. But right now, I'll take every ounce of protection I can get with this virus. And so that's why I keep saying mask, mask, mask. And most of all, we have to make sure our healthcare workers and first responders in general have the N95 respirators to protect them so that they can be there every day for us.
Absolutely. Now, what would you say to people who say, well, why don't we just worry about the highest risk people? Why don't we have focused protection? I'm not going to mention the name of that.
Yeah. You know, we do want to protect the highest level of people at most risk. But the bottom line is, you know, it's kind of like fixing three of the five screen doors in your submarine and expecting it to be a normal trip. You know, it's not. You can't bubble ourselves out of this. Workers, for example, who, you know, thank God for them, every day going to our long-term care facilities. You know, unfortunately, many of them are being paid, you know, very low minimum wages. They're making ends meet. You know, they could inadvertently bring the virus into a long-term care facility. How do you keep them out? Even with testing on a daily basis, we see challenges occurring there. So we have to understand, under the most ideal of conditions, we can't stop transmission. Essential workers who have to go to work every day, and thank God they're there for us because they're the ones that are making sure we still have food. They're the ones that are making sure that our lights are on. They're the ones that are making sure that we still have safety in our communities. You know, they can't bubble, and many of them have underlying health problems, you know, still going to work. And so one of the challenges I think we have is helping people understand it's not a neat, nice definition of you're at increased risk, you're not. If you are at increased risk, we'll just bubble you up, you're gone. And if you aren't, go do whatever you want. It doesn't work that way. And finally, I just have to emphasize, you know, surely from a number standpoint, being older, having underlying health conditions, you know, all those put you at higher risk of having a serious illness and even dying. But I know far, far too many young, healthy adults who have died from this virus, and as well as are now experiencing long haulers condition, this chronic post-illness condition. And some of the studies right now are supporting that up to 10 to 20% of young, healthy adults who get infected initially don't have serious illness, but go on and develop this long haulers condition. you know, severe fatigue, brain fog, you know, pains, et cetera. With, if you look at their x-rays, they still have heart damage, they have lung damage that's occurred, and you don't want that either. So, you know, the idea that you can bubble your way out of this pandemic in terms of preventing severe illness is just not reality.
Right. And what about people who say, well, I had it already, I have antibodies?
You know, and that may be true. People have had it. And we're all trying to understand right now, how do we determine where do we get to the next level in society once we get vaccines, once we've had people who have been infected? You know, do they need to continue to wear masks? Do they need to distance? These are all questions we're going to have to answer, and they're legitimate questions. You know, we want to get back to a new normal. That new normal will always understand that, you know, we don't want to swap air any more than we have to with friends, neighbors, colleagues, people riding on public transportation with us. But at the same time, you know, we are going to want to get back to doing things like, you know, I can't wait to take my grandkids back to the Twins baseball games. Oh my, do I miss them. Those are the games, by the way, where the Twins beat the Yankees. So anyway, you know, I can't wait. I can't wait for that to happen. But the question is, when will that happen? Will it be when somebody's vaccinated, when somebody has antibody from having an illness? How long do they last? If I do get antibody from illness, is it protective for X months, for X years? We don't know. So, you know, this is a very important question, a very legitimate question, and we need to answer it. And right now, I think from a science perspective, we're trying to. And one of the things that by, you know, this spring and summer, we're going to have better answers to say this is what you can expect. And part of it is also, how do you prove it? Meaning that if you think you've had the infection, most people who weren't tested before are still at a point where we don't know they really had COVID-19. So we've got a lot of questions left here, but the question's a really good one that we have to address.
And about the vaccines, and I know I've heard you talking about how about half the population right now would not take a vaccine. I've had parents who say to me, I'm terrified I'm going to be forced to give it to my child.
Yeah. Well, right now, we surely need to acquire a lot more information on how it might be used in children. You know, the studies are just beginning to look at children. And first and foremost is always safety. And then from there, we look at effectiveness. You know, we're in a situation where we would love to have 5, 6, 7 years worth of safety data. But we're in a pandemic where, you know, yesterday we lost 3,700 people in this country. It was number one cause of death. You know, we have a natural tension here of making certain that we get vaccines out as quickly as possible, but make sure that they're safe and effective. And where do you make that judgment that you've got enough data to make, you know, to say that they're safe and effective? I feel confident that with the studies done to date and the history of using these messenger RNA vaccines, which, by the way, from studies on cancer vaccines, this messenger RNA has been used for some time. And there's a number of other diseases for which studies have been done using the same kind of approach. And we can say right now that, you know, that we have no evidence at all that these have long-term potential health effects from using these vaccines. We do have data showing that 15 to 20% of people who get vaccinated with these types of vaccines do have localized reactions, meaning they get a red sore arm. They may also get flu-like symptoms for a day. You know, that's not good. We don't want people to have those, but that's also a small price to pay as opposed to, you know, getting severely ill and dying. And so to me, the message is we have to help the public understand what the risk is of basically experiencing these kinds of illnesses, in the community every day and how serious they could be, life-threatening, versus what we know about the safety of the vaccine. And right now, I can tell you personally, I can't wait to get my vaccine. I'll get in line when it's my turn. I don't want to budge ahead of anybody who needs it more than me, but I can't wait to get it. And I've told all my family that, all my loved ones. You know, I have 5 grandchildren who mean the world to me. I wouldn't want them taking a vaccine if I weren't completely confident in the safety and the benefits compared to not being vaccinated.
Absolutely. And I think we can also reassure the public that no one's getting forced to get this vaccine.
Nobody's getting forced to get this vaccine. On the other hand, the more people that get it, again, it's like we talked earlier with herd immunity. Mm-hmm. The more immune rods are in that virus transmission reaction, we slow down transmission. So just like with childhood immunizations, one of the things we want to do is collectively help each other protect each other. And the more people that get vaccinated, that's exactly what happens.
Right, but it's going to be a time to build the trust in it.
It absolutely is going to be time to build trust. And that's this is now. This is the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is where we need to do much more work with our doctors and nurses mm-hmm. and public health professionals. They, too, deserve the information. I mean, you know, we're all kind of, you know, making this up as we go, you might say, in terms of information. You know, the public is getting information on what's happening with these vaccines. At the same time, the health community is getting information. So, I mean, you and I oftentimes are reading the very same articles that make the headlines today that the public sees. And so we really have to do a very comprehensive job of helping to educate healthcare professionals so that they then in turn can help educate the general public. And that's why, you know, the work that you're doing and how you're working to get this information out is so important. It's very important.
Right. It takes a lot of work to build trust. I mean, one of the things that I want to say one more thing. I know you're going to have another meeting in like a minute or two, and I appreciate your time so much. I just have one more question, and that's
sure,
your thoughts
away.
About the CDC. Because, yes, I had a parent already call before the CDC even announced officially that they changed the quarantine recommendations with her child in the basement still.
Yeah.
And he leave quarantine. So I just want your opinion on
I
that.
I think it's a good thing. I think mm-hmm. I've been saying it for some time. You know, the potential for people to be infected and not show signs or symptoms, you know, 10 days to 14 days is very, very, very low. And if you are quarantining 5 to 7 days with a test at the, you know, 7 days, and if you're not getting tested but going to 10 days, just like CDC said, I think that is by far going to prevent many, many more cases in our community. You know, one of the challenges we had, and we basically said some of you have been a contact, you're exposed, you need to quarantine for 14 days. That was a big burden to put on people. And we had a lot of people who failed to do that, not because they weren't good people, but they said, you know, I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to have a real challenge here. How do I isolate myself? You know, I live in a multi-generational apartment with my two kids and my parents. How do we bubble? And so I think every effort should be made to take the science we have and say, also, what's the most practical approach? So I think this was a good thing, and I very much support it.
Right. And one thing that I haven't heard said is that because it's so prevalent and because it's spread asymptomatically, there's lots of spread that's going on that you don't know about.
Absolutely. That's exactly the truth. That's why we all say, you know, we got to stop swapping air.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Don't swap air with people. That's really important. So as much as you can, you know, respiratory protection, we just talked about that, you know, distancing yourself, you know, trying not to be in crowds, et cetera. Now, if you're an essential worker, I wish I could give you better news on what to do there. You know, mask up as you can, but it's really a combination of all these things to reduce risk. And remember, there's light at the end of the tunnel here. There is light. That's what, you know, I would hate to see many of us afflicted by this virus and have serious illness and die just days to weeks before the vaccines are going to start coming and that we can get protection that way.
Right. I think of the analogy of a woman in labor and at the last moments in transition, when she's about to give birth, she thinks this is too much. I'm going to give up. And then she has the baby.
You got to do it. Right. So, well, you know, and thank you again for all you're doing and appreciate your efforts here. And, you know, however we can help you, you know, we're always here for you at SIDRAP. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I cannot begin to thank you. And I know you have to go. And everyone should listen to your podcast.
Thank you.
My Osterholm Report. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much. Have a good one. Take
care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.